This interview was recorded for the International Bomber Command Centre Digital Archive, which owns the copyright for this performance.
Right, we're in business. We're ready to start. Okay, thank you.
Right. My late husband was Flight Lieutenant Edward Brooks, DFC, DFM. Now, Ted hadn't meant to join the RAF. He'd already started work as an office boy in London and had joined the Home Guard. But he wanted to join the Army, so he went to the Army recruiting office, and all was going well until, with the innocence of youth, he stated that he wished to join the Oxford and Bucks, the regiment in which his uncle, Company Sergeant Major Edward Brooks, had been awarded the Victoria Cross in 1917. The recruiting sergeant looked up and said, "You can't pick and choose, sonny." To which Ted replied, "Right, I'll go and join the RAF." This he promptly did, his date of enlistment, February 1941. But he was dismayed to learn that they were unable to take him immediately. But they gave him a lapel badge to indicate that he'd enlisted and that they would let him know. The months passed, and although he must have been very busy working during the day and Home Guard duties at night, he just wanted to be in the service. So after several months had elapsed, he wrote to the Air Ministry. 2 weeks later, he was at Uxbridge. There followed the initial 3 months training course at Blackpool. There they were billeted in a former seaside boarding house. They had to surrender their ration books to the landlady, and they were always hungry. Their meals were served in the dining room, but they soon realised that the corporal in charge of the billet had all his meals in the kitchen with the landlady and was enjoying much better fare. On the day they all left to register their dissatisfaction, they nailed a kipper to the underside of the dining table. Another memory of Blackpool was, before leaving, they were lined up, sleeves rolled up, and given multiple vaccinations. Then they were allowed to go home on leave before their next posting. Ted collapsed on arriving home and taken by ambulance to RAF Kenley Hospital, they live nearby, where vaccine fever was diagnosed and where he spent most of his leave. The chapter Ted contributed to Lancaster at War II as wireless operator follows his training up to OTU, where, as he said, he met the RAAF. At some time during those previous months, his mother, always concerned for her son's comfort, was worried that his regulation shirts were too rough. So she bought him officer's shirts, which she sent to him and which he wore on a night out to the local town. He was, however, picked up by the MPs and put on a charge for this offence. This was quickly followed by an individual posting to Northern Ireland to serve on a small anti-aircraft observation unit, miles from anywhere. The isolation of this unit and the ever-present threat of the IRA made him sleep with his rifle alongside. They were a small group of young lads, unused to cooking for themselves, so each one took their turn to be cook for the day, buying meat and vegetables from the local farmers. Stew was the main meal of the day, but Ted was horrified to see how it was being cooked. Meat and vegetables were thrown into a large saucepan, potatoes, carrots, etc., just as they had been lifted from the ground, complete with the soil. Ted said that he'd do the cooking. Thence to OTU at Lichfield, where they crewed up. Five of the crew were Australian, with the pilot being Murray Brown. I had the privilege of knowing Murray Brown and John Clark, his 460 Squadron pilot, in post-war years when they visited the UK. The crew were posted to 12 Squadron at Wickenby, a satellite station of Binbrook. The commanding officer was Group Captain Huey Edwards, who was the CO of Binbrook. Many post-war years later, Ted saw an article by Group Captain Basil Crummie, who said he was Wickenby's first CO. Ted said he'd confirm the facts by writing to Sir Huey Edwards VC, who kindly wrote at some length, explaining that for a short while he was in charge of Binbrook, Wickenby and one other station, Basil Crummie taking over from him soon after. I realised a little while ago that these letters from Sir Huey should be in an appropriate archive, and I donated them to the RAAF Museum, Melbourne. And so Ted's first tour commenced on the 13th of May 1943, the target being Bochum. The operation had to be abandoned after crossing the enemy coast due to an outer engine catching fire. And they had decided that they would have to ditch. But Murray went into a steep dive, and mercifully the fire went out. When looking through their list of targets, it illustrated Bomber Command's Battle of the Ruhr, known to the crews as Happy Valley. Also Peenemünde, Berlin, Cologne, Turin, Genoa and Hamburg. Many years later, in the 1950s, we sailed along the River Elbe to Hamburg. As we reached our moorings, Ted looked to the other bank, where there was a large sign, Blommenvoss. Ted said that the shipyard had been their aiming point. Their tour finished with Stuttgart on the 8th of October, 1943. After returning from Mannheim, they were on their crew bus on their way from dispersal to the interrogation room when it collided with a petrol tanker which had broken down on the perimeter track. They were all pitched forward off their seats and were dazed for some seconds. Ted had been smoking at the time, but when he came to, he realised it was still in his mouth but broken in half. They hadn't realised, however, that a member of the crew had been pitched out. They continued some considerable time later when he appeared in the briefing room and amongst other things was asked for his escape rations. He said he couldn't as he'd had to eat them on the long trek back. On their leave, on the 22nd of October 43, the crew made a BBC broadcast entitled Lancaster Crew Describes an Operation. I found in Ted's papers a receipt from the BBC for £3. Ted was then posted to Lindholm instructing. He said that one night in the mess, squadron leader John Clark came up to him and said that he was forming a crew to do a second tour. Would Ted like to join him? Yes, he said, and so to his posting to Binbrook and 460 Squadron. The first operation there was the 22nd-23rd May on Dortmund and the last 16th September, Rhein, which was the night of Arnhem. The pattern of this tour was essentially supporting the invasion. On D-Day, 5th-6th June 44, their target was the Normandy coastal batteries, in which over 1,000 aircraft were involved. their target being the battery St. Martin de Varville. The following night, the important six-way junction near Rue Junction near Bayer and the forest de Cerisay. There followed oil plants, flying bomb sites, culminating in their final operation, 16th, 17th September, Arnhem. Bomber Command's main operations that night were in support of the following day's landings. Several surrounding airfields were to be bombed. 460's target was Rhein. However, John Clark's crew was selected to remain behind after bombing Rhein. They were secretly briefed to carry out a low-level reconnaissance over Arnhem and told that because of the importance of this assignment, the radio equipment would be modified to take quartz crystals so that the tuning would be spot on to transmit their observations. Just as Ted was about to enter the aircraft, the signals officer drew up, thrusting two small objects into his hands. "I don't know how to use them," said Ted. "Neither do I," said he, "but you've plenty of time to find out." So ended his operational career. During this time, I'm not sure whether it was 12 or 460, Ted had been feeling very unwell during the day, but they were told that they would be taking two high-ranking army officers on that night's operations, as they wished to observe the German anti-aircraft defences. During the flight, Ted felt very sick, but there was no suitable receptacle. He looked down, and by his position, he saw two upturned army caps. These he suitably filled, and then dispatched them down the flare chute. On landing, the two chaps searched for their caps, but they were told by the crew that very strange things happened at night. He always suffered from severe migraines in post-war years. This he attributed to the fact that on one trip, shrapnel had penetrated the fuselage and severed his oxygen tube. He didn't tell his pilot at the time, as he knew it had been very dangerous to reduce height, and did not do so until it was safe. However, he said the pain in his head was just unimaginable. After Bimbrook, I believe it was back to Lindholm. There they would take ground crews to see the destruction in Germany. On one separate occasion, the crew had to fly to the Luftwaffe base on the island of Sylt, purpose unknown. They dined in the mess with the German officers, and I understand it was rather a tense situation. After time, he flew to Brussels, but burst a tire on landing. They were there 1 month before a replacement tire was obtained. He said that he had volunteered for Tiger Force and that he had crewed up. I believe this was the plan for the RAF and USAF bombing campaign of Japan, and I found confirmation of this in his 460 records. Finally, in summer 1946, he was demobbed at Swindoppie. You will note that in the 12th Squadron crew list, I didn't name the mid-upper gunner. This is because on July 28th, 29th, they were briefed for Cologne, and during the outward flight, he had collapsed, very distressed, and had to be physically restrained by other crew members. The operation had to be abandoned, and they returned to base after dropping their bombs in the sea. After that, they had several replacement MUGs. He finally left the service in August 1945 from RAF Swindoppie.
Thank you very much.